and thanks for tuning in to Beats Research Radio, a podcast and YouTube channel dedicated to disseminating science and research to the community. My name is Nicole Chu, and I'll be your host on this week's episode. Joining us is Dr. Annie Huang. Dr. Huang is a pediatric neuro-oncologist and scientist with the Cell Biology Research Program and the Arthur and Sonia Labatt Brain Tumor Research Center at SickKids Hospital. She holds a Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in Rare Childhood Brain Tumors and is a professor of pediatrics with laboratory medicine and pathobiology at the University of Toronto. Dr. Huang started the Rare Brain Tumor Consortium, a global collaborative network with the goal of improving the survival of children diagnosed with rare brain tumors. Dr. Huang, we are so honored to have you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be invited.
So I'd like to start off by asking a little bit about the Rare Brain Tumor Consortium. Do you mind giving us like a general overview of how it was started and just how it works?
So it was started quite a while ago, even though we didn't officially have a website many years later. The idea started when I was in training. I encountered patients who, you know, we often didn't have either a confusing diagnosis, or we had a diagnosis where we felt there wasn't enough information to make a decision about how to treat the child. And what struck me at that point was that we would say it's a rare disease, so nobody knows anything about it. But in a hospital like ours, of this size, I mean, those rare children were seen anywhere from, you know, 4 to 6 times a year. And so to me, not to have to have the same answer seemed at least not acceptable to me. And so I started with the idea of, you know, collecting all of this information and material from around the world to try and put them all in one place so that we could sort of look at them and learn from every child diagnosed with these rare diseases around the world. So that started very small. We started with maybe 14 children from our own institute over a period of decades. And then as we grew, we've now grown to about materials and information from around, you know, 1,700 to 2,000 patients from 140 centers around the world and in roughly 35 countries. So I think the important thing to know is that even though we call them rare, they're not that uncommon. So in children, you know, we have many different types of brain tumors. The largest category of malignant brain tumors in children is called embryonal brain tumors. And so these rare tumors that we study is actually comprises 40% of that category. So in effect, it isn't a small group of patients. I mean, they're individually not common, but as a class, they're not a small proportion of the population. And the second important fact about that is that the majority arises in children who are less than 5 years of age, where we struggle the most in terms of what we give them, because it has the potential to cause developmental harm and things like that. So as a population, they were what we would call a very neglected population, an orphan disease, but really they're not that uncommon.
Oh, I see. So by its name, like the Rare Brain Tumor Consortium focuses on like rare brain tumors, as you mentioned, these embryonal tumors, but just which specific ones, like which rare brain tumors does your laboratory focus on?
So we started with a very, if you look at the brain tumor classification, what we call the broad embryonal brain tumors, 60% of them are tumors called medulloblastoma, and they arise in the back of the head in the cerebellum. And those are the majority, 60%. And then the 40% were historically called primitive neuroectodermal brain tumors that looked like medulloblastoma but arose in different other parts of the brain. But that diagnosis was always a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that if it didn't fit anything else, then it must be this. So it never really sat well with the community that we didn't really know what they were. And they were called many different names. They were either classified on the basis of location or a specific type of, you know, histologic picture that the pathologist would recognize. We knew that, you know, even when we treated these patients with the most intensive therapy, they did less well than medulloblastoma. So there was something about them that was different. So over time now, that constellation of patients have become several molecular categories. And so by collecting patients sort of all together, we had the benefit of being able to study these with sort of the state-of-the-art genomics tools where you were agnostic to whatever people call them. You were just going to use the molecular data to say, are they the same or are they different? And so from those sorts of studies, we now recognize at least within this umbrella, there are at least three or four broad categories of tumors that have different molecular features. So the one that has been recognized a long time ago, before the global analysis, was this group called rhabdoid brain tumors, where they have a single gene alteration that was recognized. We now recognize that there are other gene alterations that can contribute to that group based on molecular analyses, large-scale molecular analyses. So that's one group of patients. Then the second group of patients is called ETMRs, which was recognized, you know, through our efforts and efforts of others as a very aggressive form of baby brain tumors, as we call them, and that was first recognized somewhere around in the early 2000s. And then we identified the marker in 2009 that has helped us to recognize these diseases. And then the third category, which is still in flux, is a collection of smaller molecular categories, but the that for which we don't really understand what the disease means yet. So we know there's a molecular marker, but we don't really know how the patients behave, what we expect. And so the last sort of more defined category is a category called pineoblastoma, which arises in the deep recesses of the brain that is in an organ that historically we think of as the third eye, has some connection to eye development. So the three categories that my lab really focuses on are ATRTs, ETMRs, and pineoblastoma. We sort of collect a lot of general information and clinical information on all other rare tumors and provide that to the community for studies.
Well, I see. Thank you so much for sharing that. And you mentioned how, in the beginning, how these rare brain tumors are actually not so rare, like in clinical. But I was visiting the Rare Brain Tumor Consortium website and reading about how these rare pediatric brain tumors are aggressive, poorly understood, and understudied. So I was wondering if you could expand more on why they're so understudied.
Yeah. So I think, you know, in pediatric brain tumors in general are not a common disease, right? So if you compare them to, say, lung cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, we are not a common disease. So amongst that population of children who are diagnosed with brain tumors, and we see about 100 a year, you would say that you maybe see 3 or 4 of these patients a year. So they would comprise anywhere from 3 to 45% of the brain tumors you see a year. But if you multiply that by the number of children across the world who are diagnosed with these, it is not something that is like one of a kind, really. Well, we know their names, we see them. In my practice over the course of, you know, 20 years, I would have seen, you know, anywhere from, you know, 40 to 60 patients who have this disease. So that's a lot of times when you say, I don't know, right? And as a, you know, as a place in a major academic center, our mandate is to really solve the problems that, you know, perhaps places that don't see as many children don't have the materials to do. And even then we were challenged, right? Because we, even locally, we would only see 3 to 4 years. So, and the problem, you know, everybody sees in sort of smaller centers, they might see, you know, once every few years. So it's rare to them. Certainly it's rare in the population. Bigger centers like ours, as I say, sometimes, you know, ATRTs, we might see 3 or 4 a year. ETMRs, we might see 2 or 1 a year. But we still have to deal with the problem. And I think, you know, they are aggressive tumors, but not recognizing them is the biggest problem. So if you have a bad disease, the faster you get diagnosed, the faster things can be moved so that things don't get out of hand. So yes, these tumors are aggressive, but what our studies have shown actually, you know, both for ATRT and ETMRs, is that there is a proportion of children who survive. provided you have the right diagnostic tool in place and you recognize the disease and the way it presents. So when they are rare, unlike more common diseases, there's not a textbook written about them, what should the patients look like, what should be the diagnostic features. So we have to actually generate that literature, right? So that's the reason why, like, I'm a biologist and I study things on the bench, but as a clinician, I always felt really frustrated that we had all these patients, but we had all these, I would say myths about how they presented, what they were like. You know, we would have things like they're often metastatic, or they present as very large tumors, or no matter what you do, there's 100%, death rate. And that didn't sit so well, because I think you can't make these big conclusions based on two or three patients, right? And maybe you didn't get to that patient on time, maybe other things, factored into why the patient didn't do so well. And so we made it a mandate when we started our brain tumor consortium is that we would only collect information on patients for which we had tumor tissue and the full clinical data, because one without the other doesn't help inform practice. Right? And we really wanted to make it beyond my own, interest in deep biology, really something that would help the field. So for instance, with ATRT, even though ATRT had been known for a while, early on it was thought that, there was a gene that you screen for this gene and there were only certain mutations you needed to screen for. And if it didn't fall in that category, that was not an ATRT. And we collected, a large number of patients, and recognizing this sort of presumption in the literature, we spent a lot of money to diagnose them. It was not glamorous. We went through the whole thing. There was no papers published from this except to say that we verified that they were. And what we found was actually there's not hotspots for these mutations. They're everywhere. So if you just simply focus on the hotspot, you're going to miss a lot of the patients. Right? And also just the way they present it. Many people have biases about where they should present. And then we describe many locations for these tumors and that, the groups of patients who actually did quite well, even without radiation. So these dogmas, I call them dogmas, need to be challenged with real data on patients. And so ETMR is actually perhaps even more instructive of that dogma that we get ourselves stuck in. So the dogma with ETMR started with, many different categories of tumors being called different things. But when we cloned the gene, we showed that many of these, which were in our Bible of diagnosis called WHO, were actually the same disease. They were just called different names. So that's why they were considered rare, because if you divide one by four, of course, it's even rarer than rare. So we showed that many of these diseases, by collecting them, were the same. Really agnostically looking at by molecular analyses, and the marker we cloned now identifies, greater than 90% of these tumors. And so, having that mark in place allows people to actually, use it. And we just recently published a paper where we really, really, the purpose was really to inform students of brain tumors that this tumor is not, possibly, big and in the head. The many different sort of types of ways they present. And one of the myths that was there was that these patients always came with this extensive disease. And we were quite stunned ourselves that 75% of these patients actually present with just a tumor in one place. And they were presenting in many locations, even where we thought they would be classical of other types of brain tumors. And what we also found out was nothing is futile. Nothing is futile in medicine. I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that when we are not rescuing a patient, perhaps we're using the wrong approach, right? So I think what it revealed for us that there is a group of patients actually who survive. I mean, you have to recognize that when they progress, that don't use the same old paradigm, because when they progress. You have to monitor them a different way. So I think all these fundamental things in medicine that we had for other diseases, we didn't have for this disease, including how they look on radiology. So we now have a big project with our radiology colleagues from all the database that we've set up to try and, create the literature for the basic, I call it the phenotype, the basic way a child would present with this disease so that we can help us recognize these diseases. So I think rare diseases don't necessarily have to be lethal. I think much of what happens is when people don't recognize them as the disease they are, we're not able to act on time or deliver things the right way or monitor the response treatment the right way. So that's the sort of constellation. And I think one of the major objectives of this effort was really to inform, management of patients at the bedside, not only through science, but fundamental clinical literature, which did not exist in these diseases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And part of the Rare Brain Tumor Consortium is connecting physicians across the world, like transcending cultural and language barriers to develop these tumor-specific treatment plans for patients. But just what goes into developing this type of treatment, like working internationally?
Do you mind? Yeah. So basically, we have a network of physicians who we talk to each other. If they have difficult diagnosis, they will reach out to us. And many will just simply join the consortium because they realize we're collecting information that can help, establish the care for patients. And so what we've done, for instance, in the ATRT study, we collected, our many authors and many contributors collectively enabled the effort to recognize that there's a group of patients, three different molecular groups of patients, and that these molecular groups might be associated with different clinical outcomes. And so having set this database, we were in a position now to help further refine the diagnosis of these patients, and that has been sort of disseminated worldwide. And we have developed tools at SickKids. Others have developed it based on their own data from different places. But it has actually helped our diagnostic group say there are three classes of these, so that the next generation of students will say, okay, there are three different molecular subtypes. And now the next generation of studies is asking, how do we treat the three different subtypes? And that work is being done in my lab and many other labs. So we've now suddenly had a community of people interested in the disease where there were very few before. So the field grows, and hopefully that will translate into, better treatment for these patients in many different ways. And in the ATMR community, it is with the help of all of our colleagues, and just to give you a sense of why collaboration and centralization in one place is so powerful, and because there is a vetting process, there is a quality control process. When we receive samples, we go to the 9 yards to confirm at many different levels they are what we think they are, or they are not what we think they are. So we do a lot of vetting process, because otherwise you are comparing apples and oranges in terms of the clinical picture, right? So it's not just the biology, but you're now mixing children, you would say, of different types. So we're very obsessive compulsive about that. And we spend a lot of money on that process without glamour, to be honest. That is like the commitment to make something that is worthwhile to invest in as a legacy project for generations to come, hopefully. Because we're never going to see 1,000 rare brain tumor patients on clinical trials. So we must use this information over and over again to inform the future clinical trials, right? Because we will never have this sort of information. Like, I could be, a bazillion years old. We can't produce more of this disease, right? And hopefully we won't. And so it's really important that we collect data in a rigorous, vetted way. That data also should never be depleted, that it continues to be updated. So we reach out to all of our investigators globally. We update the clinical data. If a patient's alive, we want to know how long, what other things have happened. And we also, any sort of specimen that comes into our registry is never depleted. We are very, very careful about depleting. So we have developed methods to study these tumors, really miniaturizing many assays, creating things that are, cost-effective in terms of diagnostic assays. So many of the diagnostic things that we use, like comparison, say, you know, genomic sequencing and methylation arrays are like pennies. That, you know, the Canadian healthcare system is not private. And so we also recognize that there are many countries like ours that need these sort of assays that are cheap and have access to the patient. So we freely share these assays that are developed. So my lab develops them, discovers them, we pass them on to our pathology lab that develops it and makes it affordable for many countries. And we share the data freely and the methods freely. So in the ETMR, for instance, you know, I don't think to tell you the story, we would have recognized this was one disease with so many different types of names. When we first cloned the gene, I had a student who brought me one tumor and said, oh, look at this gene, it's so different. And I would say, I don't know what that means. He was very excited, but I wasn't. I'm like, okay, maybe it's a one-off, right? And he then brought me 11 tumors. And I'm like, oh, okay, maybe we can talk a little bit about this. And then I was really suspicious of the 11 tumors because I thought, okay, this is a really unusual gene. Like, it's impossible that everybody who studied cancer hasn't found this gene. And so then I went to do the investigation to check where the tumors came from, to make sure my friends were not all sending me the same tumors. And it was actually 11 patients from 9 different centers around the world. It would have been impossible for us to make that discovery if we didn't have this network, right? And so I think it speaks to the power of collaboration. It speaks to the power of, you know, recognizing these patients when they're centralized. And so the idea of doing this seemed crazy, and people have told me, you know, I've spent a lot of my career doing this, but I think, you know, I can be satisfied that it was an effort that was worthwhile, and that we moved the field forward in a meaningful sort of way for patients who are diagnosed with these rare tumors, where even today some physicians will tell their patients, we've never heard of this tumor. And I hope that we will make that not an acceptable answer. There's always information. That's why we reach out. We spend a lot of money on creating websites and connecting with people to make sure families are empowered to access this information. And the information is free. It's not encumbered by anything. We are not a private healthcare system. People do not have to come to Canada to access that information. In fact, you know, our system doesn't allow for too much, you know, external patients coming. It's just not built that way yet. We consult widely. We offer advice widely to many people.
I truly love how you emphasize the importance of collaboration and before how like nothing in medicine is futile. And while like many of these like molecular mechanisms for rare brain tumors remain undefined, your international efforts of like bringing physicians across the world is truly like moving the field forward very much.
Yeah. Sorry. I think that's the essence of Canadian medicine and Canadian science. And certainly, I think we espouse that at SickKids. We're given an opportunity to study the most difficult diseases and help advance the health of children around the world, and not just locally, you know, in Toronto, Ontario, for sure, the rest of Canada, but certainly around the world.
Mm-hmm. I think this is like a great end note for our interview. And once again, Dr. Huang, we're so grateful for you taking the time to share your research with us today.
Thank you so much for giving me a chance to talk about our work. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And on behalf of the entire Beats Research Radio team, thank you to all the listeners for your time. Beats Research Radio is supported by the University of Ottawa Heart Institute, Beats Research Radio Laboratory, and the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa.